Yes, and I think what I think is important in documentary is it's less about, it's about the subject, but it's also about how it's supposed to make you feel, like what you leave with. I think documentary is a lot more, you like walk away with a new understanding or a different, and the one thing that that documentary made me feel was kind of shame, because the whole time you're gunning for, like, do they include the part where this man is killed by these bears? And then they're like, you savage. Like, Werner's like, look, this is a real family. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. This dude had family.
He shows the consequences of it.
The actual consequences.
Through the victims.
Mm-hmm.
And the, because we watch these movies and you're like, oh, the kill, that's the most important thing. Like,
yeah, I grew up on Faces of Death. You know what I mean? Like, that's not, I'm not bragging. I'm just stating that, I grew up on Faces of Death, so it's like my desire for to see bloodlust. Like, the bloodlust is very real.
Sure. Well, like, imagine watching Jaws, and then after the film, we find out that Quint had, like, a wife and children. And, like,
that's, you know? Exactly right. It's like, oh, you like this hero who sacrificed himself? Well, guess what? He left behind all right. This shit.
And Richard Dreyfuss's character has to go and, like, knock on their door.
And tell them.
And then there's a 20 to 30 minute further extension of the film where it's just them reckoning with it. And, like, a funeral for him. And Dreyfuss's character giving some of his trust away to help them go to school to become marine biologists.
Yeah.
But they also need therapists to get over the fact that their father was completely swallowed whole by a great white shark.
That's what I mean. Like, hats off to Werner Herzog for, like, making a documentary that was like, oh, yeah, do you want to see what happened? The grisly ending? Well, guess what? Like, you... You're a dick.
Right. You came here to see some Gorno.
Yeah.
And we're not going to show you the money shot.
Yeah, we're not going to show... We're just going to show you the tattered life that's left behind after the money shot of the terrible movie.
Yeah. So today we're not here to talk about Midsommar or Grizzly Man.
No.
But this is the Halloween episode, and that's why I decided to bring on one of my favorite comedians in the city, Zilla Von Nuts.
Oh, thank you. Hey, guys.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to be here.
So happy to have you here on a special episode of Eat, Pray, Judge. And, you know, unfortunately, Sammy's not here today, but he is here in spirit.
We love you, Sammy.
That's right. And we... And the last time you were here, we talked about another spooky movie. So, you know, this is great to have you back for a sequel. The last time you were on, we talked about Poltergeist.
Yeah, I think I'm boxing myself in. I like other movies, guys, I swear.
And then some of the best photos of you for me on social media are when you're dressed up as a bruja.
Yeah.
So you do spooky well.
Oh, why, thank you.
Like the Puerto Rican Elvira.
I would, you know, goals. That would be friggin' goals.
And today we picked one of your favorites.
Candyman.
Candyman. Yeah. So this movie came out in 1992, and I'm excited to just explore that year and this film. I'm so happy to revisit it.
So 1992, the two things that I thought related to this, well, of course, if you lived in America in 1992, you understand how tense things were. The Rodney King trial was getting started, and the Jeffrey Dahmer trial was winding down. And what's interesting about that is that Dahmer got away with a lot because of being a white man, and the Rodney King didn't get away with much at all for being a black man. So he was evading arrest, and he got just terribly beaten. Of course, everybody knows, like, famous story. But it was weird to me, looking up 1992, that on opposite ends of the spectrum, Jeffrey Dahmer was able to kill 15 men, predominantly black, simply because they didn't suspect him, even though his house smelled like rotting people.
And he looked like an OG gentrifier. Jeffrey Dahmer was kind of like, he had the affect of a Bushwick hipster. You know, he had the funny glasses, he had the weird haircut. He was, He moved into the hood. He moved into the ghetto. He lived in a predominantly African-American part of town, and nobody, and he was able to hide in plain sight because nobody talked to him.
Yeah.
And he lived in a, he lived in an apartment complex, which is also insane that, that you can, you know, it reminds me of like Kitty Genovese. There's that story of the woman who was, killed in like as
Kew Gardens.
It was at night,
yeah,
it happened, and she died. She was murdered in the street, and she was screaming, and everyone around
that Forest Hills?
Yep. Could see what was happening, but nobody called the cops because, you know, I think it's when there's a crowd of people, responsibility gets diffused.
And I think a lot of, and it's funny because the connection to that too is a lot of people thought it was a lover's spat. So like, there's that weird like they didn't get involved because they just thought it was some dude like harming his wife, which at the time was a, like a lot more. And the Dahmer thing, remember that that one victim that he had where the cops brought him back, the victim ran away and the cops brought him back because Dahmer convinced them that it was a lover's spat.
Yeah, that's right. And the person, the victim who got away, who the cops brought back was a minor, was a boy. Who I think he may have even had a hole drilled in his head at that point.
Yeah, it was from Laos. Yeah.
Sure. So he was bleeding, disoriented, and hysterical, rightfully so, completely out of sorts. And the cops, you can hear, I think there's transcripts of them like laughing it off and sort of making homophobic comments.
Yep, absolutely.
And Dahmer took him back and immediately killed him. So there's this white privilege.
Which is, yes, so it's like lack of privilege, which, you know, Rodney King, too much privilege, Dahmer, and Candyman is very much a privilege story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you're bringing up, you know, this is how polarized the 1990s were, and this dichotomy between the black experience and the white experience around crime. And, yeah, and I was... 1992, I was in middle school, and so Dahmer, you bringing up Dahmer, he was such a huge figure for, like, I went to an all-boys middle school, so we're just talking about cannibals, and everything around this story was just riveting. And then at the same time, to see, like, the L.A. riots was, and I have a lot of family in California, so, like, a whole city in flames.
Yeah, absolutely.
These were apocalyptic. One, apocalyptic on a massive scale with the riots, and then the personal depths that a human can go to being a cannibal.
Oh, yeah. And also, like, just what fed into those things. Like, once again, incredible amounts of privilege for Dahmer.
Yeah.
Apparently, like, his probation, like, he was on probation, but they never checked in on him. Like, they didn't think he was that big of a threat. And then the other thing is people who are being over-policed. So it's, like, lack of policing, over-policing.
Yeah.
And the results of both. Really quickly, before we continue, 92 is a pretty solid year for film. We have The Crying Game, which is one of my favorites.
Love the soundtrack.
Yes. Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Saw it in the theater.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer is an accompaniment to Bram Stoker's Aladdin, Malcolm X, Unforgiven, which won the Oscar, I believe, for Best Film the following year. Batman Returns, which is like one of my ultimate favorite movies.
It gets better with time.
It's amazing.
It's even better now.
I think it's Burton's best. I mean, even though Ed Wood's pretty solid. Sister Act, Wayne's World, My Cousin Vinny, White Men Can Jump, and The Bodyguard. 92 was a good year.
It's sick that Unforgiven is the one that won, because I've seen that movie a bunch, but there's other films that you just listed that I'd rather watch right now.
Oh, absolutely. My Cousin Vinny was the notable, remember when is it Marissa Tomei won the Oscar, and there's like this weird theory that like she actually didn't and it was a mistake. And
they just couldn't take it back.
Yeah, they couldn't take it back on some La La Land shit where they did take it back, which is great. But yeah, really, a league of their own. Like 92 is a solid year, and I still love film now. But some of these years in the 80s and 90s, you look at like if you just search into Google like movies from this year, you're like, wow, so many classic, fantastic movies.
Sure, hard hitting. And is it? But looking back, is it that that they were formative for us, you know?
Oh,
I always
absolutely
think about that nostalgia trap that because it's when I saw it, it blew me away.
I believe so, definitely. I mean, though, when a kid, you know, like when I work with teenagers now, and they'll be like, oh, the Tooth Fairy with the rock, that's a classic, you know? Like, I gotta be respectful of your opinion, but I don't know that that's true.
Yeah,
you
like, know? I guess the youth is always right.
But I'm trying to think what animated films come out recently. Like, Coco was great, but like, Aladdin was like, you're talking about the top of the pops. You know, we were lucky. Yeah. In that respect, we grew up with a fantastic trope of movies.
I think Little Mermaid, same, man. For me, that's a big one, dude. I can't get over it. Kiss the Girl. I hear that song all the time. I love that little crab. Sebastian. That's my,
you gotta bat your eyes like this. You gotta poker up your lips. It's amazing. It's amazing. The performances, all of that. Sebastian's amazing. All of it. So 92, Candyman, yeah. Bernard Rose, who directed Immortal Beloved, and he had directed a horror movie beforehand. It was like a light horror. British horror. British horror is different.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting. It's a British man that they brought over here to explore race and urban fears in the United States.
Well, it was his idea. So the original story is the Clive Barker story called The Forbidden, which is from the Books of Blood, which if you're a horror fan, see, I think I outgrew that whole, I used to read all the, I've read most of the Stephen King novels.
Stephen King's the reason I'm literate, I have to say. I think that, you know, like, because we'd get those required reading lists as kids, and I never wanted to read books about, like, a boy and his dog. Like, there were always, like, these sort
unless
of...
Unless they were killing people.
Right, unless it was Cujo. You know what I mean? Like, get out of here with this founder, like, Lassie-type books. I need to... I want to...
You mean, like, Hatchet and... Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I was getting these... I just felt like all the stuff that they were giving us to read was... I was disconnected from. And Stephen King was the one who was at my reading level and was just dropping some gory gems.
Yes. And so if you've read Stephen King, Clive Barker is like if Stephen King got a lot more like into BDSM and sex, and it's like it's a different vibe. He's like a great storyteller.
Yeah, he's like a new wave. He's like new wave. Stephen King is like country.
I see that. Yes.
Like, and it just because Stephen King kind of is like Americana, folksy, like he's in Maine. It all takes place in small towns. There's this nostalgia for, like, the boomer era American experience. And Clive Barker is like a British cosmopolitan
gay man. Man.
So it's just queer horror from the start in the early 90s. So I was into his movies, but I hadn't really gotten into his books.
Reading about The Forbidden yesterday, because I've read the Books of Blood, they're a lot. They're nightmarish. He goes in. Yeah. So it's a lot to process. Like, I don't think I would read them again. I've read a lot of horror when I was younger, but I think now that I'm more aware of actual horror, like from the newspaper, it's a lot difficult for me to switch into that lane for just enjoyment, like for reading enjoyment. In the Books of Blood, in The Forbidden, Candyman's not black. He's white. He has translucent skin, and he wears kind of like a technicolor dream coat. And the way that the Helen Lyle finds him is because she's doing a project on graffiti. So she's going into this abandoned housing complex, sees graffiti that speaks of this Candyman.
Yeah.
And falls down that rabbit hole.
So you say translucent skin, and I immediately think about those genetically modified frogs where you can see all their organs on the inside, which they use for science experiments.
To see what happens when you feed a frog stuff or whatever, right?
And then they're like, no, son, please. And then he's wearing a techno-colored coat. So now it's like an Invisible Man Tron. Yeah. Character.
But like Willy Wonka too, you know, like with like a foppish attire. Like.
Right. So like almost like steampunk because he's Victorian era, but he's Dayglow.
And he has a hook. So he had a hook. And cool. Then.
So it's Captain Hook meets Tron.
But sweet, you know, but candy.
With like a Liverpool accent, so he sounds like one of the Beatles.
Yes, I love all of. You've made the perfect Candyman picture. So Bernard Rose reads the story. So it's in the 90s, just like you said. So we've already painted this picture. A lot of race issues in America. And he decides that he is going to alter it. He visits Chicago, which at the time was notorious for its violence, and still is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he decides that Candyman's going to be black, and this sets off a really big red flag. And he apparently had to meet with the NAACP and assure them that it wasn't going to be just racist tropes.
Now, what I find interesting about this is that when you meet up with, like, government agents, not government, but sort of benevolent agencies, like the NAACP, I don't think it's... Is it made up of artists?
No. I would say probably at the time, if I had to guess, and this is all, like, me guessing, it's probably, like, local people who were just tired of... Like, that happens now, where they do a movie where they talk about... our current president talks about Chicago in the worst way. So they were just like, hey, because you have to get permission to shoot somewhere. So I think it was like, what exactly are you imagining from the locals? Because they were like, we're going to let you shoot here if you're going to make us look horrible. And apparently, like, people like Spike Lee, a lot of big directors from the time were very angry that he was even making this movie, and they did no comments. Like, when the movie was released, they were like, no comment. Now, in 2019, would you agree a black person is going to direct Candyman? It's a female director chosen by Jordan Peele, but that's important.
It is important. So, yeah, this is a controversial movie, and I think it's controversial because there's so many different lenses you can look at it through, and I've listened to a couple podcasts, actually, on this film since we picked it, and, you know, one podcast that's all African-American men, they have a take that I completely respect, but it wasn't what I initially, they, like, hated it, and I'm like, oh, I totally get why but at the same time, there's other lenses you can look at this through. Because, like, I know that I've seen this movie, like, 15 times.
Oh, absolutely.
And at no point do I feel as though it has negatively affected... I don't see it as sort of, like, racist propaganda.
No, but, you know, there is a big group of people in a movie that is, like, in my top 10, Gremlins. There's a large group of people. Right. Have you ever read... some people have, like... I've read a thesis once that was about the portrayal of people of color in film and Gremlins. And I could not for the life of me see what they were trying to connect, but I respected that was someone's opinion.
Absolutely. No, and I get that. And I've actually heard a stand-up comic, I can't remember who at this moment, but it has, like, brilliant jokes about how the movie Gremlins is just about black people. And it, like, or fear of them. And like, within his routine, I was like, yep, that's hilarious.
Oh,
but it's
you
not
going to
stop me from how I am enjoying this film.
Yes. So let's go into the film. Starts with Sam Raimi's brother in a story that is being retold to a woman who's an anthropology major.
Yes.
Right? There's a very lovely the beginning of it is great. It's Urban Legends.
Sure. It reminds me of the opening of, like, Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Where Peter Venkman has the students in there and he's performing tests on them. But this way where academics are interviewing interviewing, using other humans and extracting information from them.
Yes.
And, yeah, the urban legend of this hook.
So Helen is sitting these people down.
Yeah.
And she's asking them. So alligators in the sewers comes up. And Candyman comes up quite a few times. And... watching it with 2019 eyes, I still wasn't offended by how it's introduced. So she's playing a recording, and one of the women who's cleaning the college.
That's right. One of the janitors.
Yeah, one of the, cleaning staff.
Custodians.
Custodians is like, oh, Candyman? Yeah. That's, wait, you don't know that story? And it takes a turn. Because I don't think... Helen is super foolish, and I think that's what I don't know if the guys said this, but it's really, truly, to me, the story is about a woman who goes in too deep, in over her head, on a culture that it does not belong to hers.
Yes.
For her own purposes.
Well, Amber's, I'm watching this with my fiancé, and Amber's, she's blonde and white, and she's like, oh, this movie's too close to home.
Yeah.
It's about a well-intentioned white woman who gets terrorized by she's, you know, she's curiosity kills the cat.
Yes.
You know, she's Helen is an ambitious academic who wants to make her bones in anthropology with a husband and his friends, boys club. She's trying to enter the boys club.
Yep.
And publish some work that's going to get her the respect that the men in her colleagues that are men already have. And in her I guess she doesn't really have a bunch of flaws. She's not a good person, but she's not a bad person. She's ambitious.
No, and what the story does to, she pays. She pays in kind, like, so, okay. So, funny enough, Virginia Madsen's fantastic in it. They do a very lovely thing where whenever someone discusses Candyman or she talks about him, they light her eyes very soft. It reminded me very much of an older movie. It's like a very romantic, weird thing that they do. So when the boys club,
yeah.
So she's like, well, the one flaw you guys had when you researched this was that you didn't go to the neighborhood and actually talk to the people. And the guy's like, oh, well, I already know the story of Candyman. And he's like, he was the child of a former slave who was well off, went to the best schools, which was what watching it now for this purpose was really heartbreaking to me. They go through great pains to say that Candyman did everything right.
Man, I want to talk about, like, let's spend some time right now talking about the Candyman character,
mm-hmm,
and his backstory. And you hit it, right? He's a freeman. His son, or he's the son of a liberated slave,
mm-hmm,
and a guy who made a fortune after being enslaved. Shoes,
yeah.
A process to mass produce shoes after the Civil War. So Candyman, I think we find out in the sequel that his name is Daniel.
I don't know that girl. Like, I remember when they asked Mariah Carey, like, I don't know who that is. Like, I'm, yeah, the sequel, Farewell to the Flesh, that's not even in my, what do we know?
Right.
We're only, okay, but
so,
yes.
So Candyman, he is the son of this liberated man, and he was educated, like you said, man. He speaks multiple languages. He dresses well. He is cultured, cultivated.
He's an artist.
He's imaginative, right? As, yeah, an artist, he's a guy who lives a life of the mind, obviously sensitive and perceptive of the world around him. And he's so talented that high society pays him to paint portraits of all of them.
And then he gets a white woman pregnant.
Bong. Don't do that.
So right?
He gets a white
woman. It's not allowed.
In Chicago, this happened. So this isn't in the Deep South. This is happening in the 1890s in Chicago. So pretty almost to the now, you know, not now, but like 100 years ago from when the movie takes place.
Yes.
And, he's brutally lynched by, his lover's father and,
yes,
the crowd.
Smeared with, bees, honeycomb. And that's like the, where it gets like kind of, you know, like horror, it goes back to the horror movie.
This is where I learned the word apiary. Was from this,
yes,
movie. They're like, and then they went and they robbed an apiary and took the bees.
And like, your impression of that man,
yeah,
is spot on. So, all right. So there's an interesting thing that happens with the lighting when he's telling her this story,
yeah,
because it's almost like pre-woke. Cause in 92, that wasn't a word. That wasn't a thing,
sure,
but it's like Helen gets woke. And that's when the trouble starts, where she starts to try this pursuit of a greater understanding, where she wants to be like this man. She feels that this boys club has a very basic and superficial view of Candyman, and now she wants to pursue that lead.
Right. He's a sympathetic character for her now. I mean, he's a victim. So, and this is very unique, right? Because this is the first black slasher, and maybe the first black, explicitly black villain in horror outside of Blackula.
Yes.
And I might be getting that wrong, but that's, hey, we're saying he's the first. And when we look at all the other
popularized, the first popularized.
Right, right. And you look at like all of the other popular slashers from this era, and it's like
Jason.
Jason
Freddy.
Is a mute Hulk whose motivation, drowned, and his motivation is to get revenge on, for his mother's death, maybe, and to murder all the horny teens trying to bone in the woods. That's his motivation.
Yeah.
Then you've got Michael Myers, who, if you watch the Rob Zombie remake, was sort of like a child of a juggalo family. who gets possessed when he hits puberty and when has to murder everyone.
When you said that, the first thing, anytime someone brings up that movie, all I think is Love Hurts. And it's his mom on the stripper pole, and it's Sherry Moon Zombie.
Hot take, man. I love that first half of Rob Zombie's Halloween so much.
Okay, so Halloween.
So then we've also got Leatherface, who's a cross-dressing, special needs, like, mute adult who just wants to cook dinner for his family.
Yes.
Unfortunately, he likes to cook human meat for his family, so that's why he's a monster. But these are all characters who are not, they don't have, like, sympathetic origin stories. And then Freddy is a grotesque-looking, burned-up pedophile who maybe because this the parents burned him alive in a vigilante act, maybe there's some sin there, but his whole motivation is to kill the children of these people that murdered him. But then you've got this and Freddy's kind of like this bridge, because he's what I consider like a verbal charismatic monster.
He got jokes. He got one-liners.
Dude, yeah, he's roasting people.
He's roasted and roasting.
Yeah. But he's the bridge, because the other verbal monsters that I would think of are like Dracula, who's a seductive monster. You know, he's got the gift of gab, and then you've got Pinhead, who's also verbal, and he's all about bargaining, and Hannibal Lecter.
But Freddy was the first funny verbal, because then Chucky kind of ran off with that. Do you get what I mean?
Totally.
Where it's like there was like one-liners and puns in the things that they said.
I think they realized that children are the prime audience for these things.
Accidental audience.
Yeah.
VHS tapes snuck into slumber parties. People lying about their age to get into an R movie. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because I watched these things, all of these movies, before the age of 14, I think. And that was the prime time for me to watch these horror movies, was around like between 10 and 15. And these are all brutal films that deal with very, what would quote unquote, mature topics. But
Candyman actually deals with.
Yes.
So watching it when I was younger, the one takeaway I had was that one scene where she talks to her therapist and she's like, I can bring him here.
Yeah.
And so we'll go to that. But like, I only remembered the scariest parts of it. But watching it now, even something like the title sequence, they're going over the
beautiful
Chicago.
Yeah.
And it's about transitioning. It's about moving from one neighborhood to the other, which is what essentially the movie is all about. It's a gentrification. It's a movie about poverty. So really quickly, Eddie Murphy was supposed to be Candyman.
Oh, hell yeah.
Which then I feel like, because they didn't meet his salary requirements, he then was like, I'm going to do Vampire in Brooklyn, because I feel like he was like trying to pivot.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock was the front runner for Helen if Virginia Madsen hadn't taken it. And one of the things I thought was very interesting is when we were talking about the Bernard Rose met with the NAACP, they asked him politely to make, Helen's friend a black actress.
Sure, representation matters.
Bernadette.
By Vanessa Williams.
Well, no, that's Vanessa Williams is Anne Marie, the tenant. Bernadette.
Excuse me. Yes.
Bernadette is played by Casey Lemons, who directed Eve's Bayou and is directing Harriet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she directed episodes of Luke Cage. So Tony Todd takes it. And the reason I went to casting is because, so we just said, Candyman's very sympathetic. He's also stunningly good looking. Like, the look. Like,
well-dressed.
That's a G.
Tall, dark, handsome, mysterious.
Yes. And save for the fact when he occasionally opens his jacket to reveal his ribcage, you look at him and on paper, you're like, yo, that's a good-looking dude. You know?
Yes.
So, like, the romanticism is very high. And, in fact, Tony Todd...
It's a love story.
Yes. And Tony Todd said the reason that he took it at first was he'd been a theater actor, and friends were like, don't do a slasher. You'll be that slasher for the rest of your life. And he said that he liked it so much because it was like his own personal Phantom of the Opera. He thought it was a lot like Phantom of the Opera, which he'd always had like a soft spot for.
Now, this is an area where like people have found this film problematic, is that with all these other slashers, they are monstrous in some regard because of the masks they wear or the burned skin or looking like monsters. But it's his blackness that's monstrous. He's just good looking. He's like a highly educated, good looking, tall black man who happens to murder white women.
Which is why I would say throughout that the truest victim, I don't think of him as a monster. Like, right. Candyman is a victim of, like, circumstances. He's a victim throughout. And, like, that's, I guess, why I've always had, like, a kind of a soft spot for him. Because, so, an interesting thing that happens is Helen realizes her building is the same, like, built layout as Cabrini Green, which does not exist anymore. Cabrini Green was knocked down in Chicago and now looks a lot like Williamsburg. I went about 2 years ago on a business trip. And so the projection, Helen going to Cabrini Green in the movie, that actually happened in real life. That neighborhood is now not a black neighborhood. It is a gentrified neighborhood, a very pricey neighborhood.
Absolutely. Well, it was so Cabrini Green was never the worst neighborhood in Chicago. It's that it is the public housing closest to the Gold Coast.
Yes.
So it just happens to border where all the affluent white people are. And that's why it got the most press.
Yes.
It's not like
the more dangerous than anywhere else. Yeah. And I think Bernadette, the character Bernadette, says that when they're driving over, she has a bag and it's like pepper spray and all this stuff. And she doesn't want to go. And there's that funny thing, which once again, like, they dress like cops.
Right. They look like Cagney and Lacey.
To go to Cabrini Green to essentially, for their own selfish reasons. The reason they're going is to make their thesis better.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, they're extracting value, more value out of impoverished people.
Yes.
So it's internal colonialism.
Absolutely. And they do a funny thing. So as she demonstrates, like, the medicine cabinet mirror, if you wanted to take that lead, like if you want a reach, there's very Alice in the Looking Glass. Like she's going into another world.
Exactly. A mirror opposite.
Mirror opposite. Someone else's apartment across town. Completely different life. And that's how she meets Anne Marie, which is the tenant. You said played by Vanessa Williams.
Yeah.
Who has the baby. And
Anthony.
Yes. And once again, a reach. I think there's an interesting little tidbit there that can be read into about snitch culture. Anne Marie engages with Helen.
That's right.
So does the little boy. I don't remember his
name. I feel so bad for that little boy.
And later, when there's that scene. So Helen goes back. She gets attacked by a guy who says, like, he's like, I'm Candyman, bitch. Oh, no. We hear you're looking for Candyman, bitch. And knocks her out. Yes. Right? And then they do this scene that is a lot like the scene in The Usual Suspects. Give me the keys, cocksucker, right? Where they do the lineup and everyone says the line over and over and over again. And she picks out who it was and she thinks she solved it because she's a white lady and she's dumb. She's like, look, I called Candyman, y'all. I came to see a neighborhood for 2 days and I solved the crime. The
white savior.
Yes.
She's like Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Minds, but it's a spooky dangerous mind.
It's spooky dangerous minds. She tells that little boy, who's a little boy that like kind of gives her more of the lore.
Yeah.
Tells her about the little boy that got his penis cut off, right?
Yes.
And he's like, you promised me you weren't going to go to the police. You told me it was our secret. And that's why there was a weird thing with snitch culture there. Because then he's like, Candyman's not real. And then this is where Helen's problems begin. Because she attempts to debunk Candyman.
And this is also where, I don't know if you've seen The Wire, but there's like a kid in The Wire in season 4 or 5 who ends up, they think that he's working with the cops, so they firebomb his family's house, and he ends up going into a group home. His whole life is devastated by even the idea that he might have been a snitch. And this film could have had a scene like that, where Candyman extracts revenge on this boy, or where like the locals from Cabrini Green get this boy. Because Helen, she leaves devastation everywhere in her wake, unintended.
She kills, so the dog is killed. Candyman kills the dog. And they also take the baby, Anthony.
Yeah.
So now they're trying to solve this case. So here is where the tide turns, right? Candyman comes, Helen blacks out. Candyman, she's back in the woman's apartment.
Sure.
The baby's missing. The dog is dead.
Oh, there's blood everywhere. It's just like the scene in Godfather when the guy wakes up in the bed with the horse head in his bed.
Yes. It's a Rottweiler head. And then she gets taken in, and from here on out is when she has lost all of her privilege. It's just like stripped away little by little by little, right?
And this is brilliant. Because it feels like this inversion of what the black experience.
Well, the looking glass. She went to the other side. So now she went and visited the other side. She's going to get treated as such. So now this policeman, who initially worked with her to find the dude that they thought was Candyman, doesn't let her get in a word in edgewise.
Yeah.
He refuses to, like, she gets the intake scene. It's very slow. And I remember as a kid thinking it was weird. But now watching it for what I think Bernard Rose was trying to say... is now you're this, now you're going to go through this experience that you were unfamiliar. Yes. So she is put through the system. They don't believe a word she says, but she has money. So she gets out.
She gets a lawyer, right?
Yeah. She gets out they pay her bail, right? We didn't touch on this, but throughout the fantastic Philip Glass, score, which is just chef kiss to me for the movie. He hated the movie. He hated the fucking movie. He thought it was what a lot of people do think, that it was a garish representation of a culture.
Yeah.
He softened on that stance, but initially he wanted nothing to do with the movie. He thought that Bernard Rose tricked him.
Sure.
So Helen gets put through the system, and that's when everything starts to fall apart. She makes contact with Candyman, and Candyman's like, yo, you told them I wasn't real. So now, is that a symbiote? Like, I'm going to use you to make people believe that I'm real again. Because he starts to manipulate her.
Yes, she becomes the pawn.
She becomes the pawn. And what is it? I'm the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom. She's got to bring his legend back up.
Yes. And so, yeah, this movie's got all these different themes. I mean, that's one lens to look at this through that where I think it's a powerful film is this idea of legends and like the power that comes with belief.
Yes.
And pouring belief into people and things.
And he calls it like probably the start of the second act. He tells her, your death will be a tale to frighten children. Like, Helen's not going to live.
Yeah.
Candyman's already decided, like, in that respect, it becomes almost like in the way that The Ring was, where it's like, once you've dabbled in this thing, there's, like, kind of, like, no way out. We're just going to see how far you can get to redeem yourself, because Helen does have to redeem herself, because baby Anthony is missing.
Right. And Anthony's been missing. So she's in the psych ward for a month, which means that Anthony's been missing for a month. And Candyman has just been letting this kid suckle on his finger, maybe drinking, like, ghost honey or whatever. Because he's fine. Anthony's totally chilling.
Yeah, Anthony's chilling once again, which is why my theory is that, like, Candyman isn't actually the villain. Because it's like, if a small baby could stay with the villain for X amount of time and survive.
Right, right. He's, like, definitely keeping him swaddled, like, warm, you know. Yeah, so I'm cool. I'm down with Candyman's babysitting abilities.
Yes, and also up to Anthony, as you said, she's in the psych ward for a month. And a big thing, I think, is there's a disenfranchisement through, like, getting processed in the jail system. She's made to feel crazy, and people think the worst of her. No one believes she's innocent. That's, I think, the beauty of what they were really trying to say, is the nightmare, a white woman's nightmare. The worst thing that could possibly happen to a white woman is that no one would believe her, even though she knows she's innocent, but it doesn't matter because she played in that sandbox, and that's what happens in that sandbox. You get processed. There's no due process. You know, you're just, the book is thrown at you. So now she has to, she's like, yo, if I find baby Anthony, then I can make it all better.
Right, right. It's if I can find out who killed JonBenet Ramsey, if I can find out what happened to Casey Anthony's baby.
So she gets out, she goes to the house, kills Bernadette, the Candyman kills Bernadette, which is heartbreaking because it's just like Bernadette's not really in the mix. She's just there.
Again, collateral damage. So yes. Sad.
She was also in Fear of a Black Hat, which is really good. Casey Lemons.
Love that movie.
Yes, fantastic.
Also, but, you know, it, and she never said, she didn't say Candyman five times. She only said it four. So I don't know why Bernadette's getting killed.
Oh, snap. Which, you know, right now, if you ask me to say Candyman five times to a mirror, I would say no. That's just, I'm not saying Candyman's real. I'm just saying I'm respectful of this made up idea. But, so after that, so this was the scene that, like, she gets taken back into the psych ward. So Bernadette ends up dead when she's out on bail. She gets taken back to the psych ward. They make her feel crazy. They show her a video where Candyman is missing, and now she's really having a crisis.
Yes.
So she's like, I'm going to bring him back. She calls him back. The therapist gets killed. And the coolest stunt in the whole damn movie, Candyman goes backwards out of the window, which is just super cool looking, pre-CGI.
The practical effects in this movie are tremendous. And the body count in this film is super low. And the goriest scene is that therapist getting murdered,
yes,
which is halfway through the film.
Yes.
If not more.
And then what ends up happening is when people think the worst of you, you give in. Knowing that no one will believe her now, she's seen the tape and she's like, they got me. She just is like, all right, bet. So she knocks down a nurse in the psych ward, takes her outfit, walks out of the, you know, that's a stretch, but leaves. And they do this really wonderful thing where she's on a bridge in Chicago and Candyman says, they will all abandon you. And yeah, they have. He's taken all of her support.
Sure. Well, then he's made his offer to her so much more appealing.
Yes.
Eternal
and
life.
Also, once again, because he's good looking. He covered in bees, but he's so good looking. So, yes, this is where that happens, where the kiss happens.
Yeah.
Which he wore a dental dam to stop the bees from going down his throat.
Wow.
Yeah. And also, cool tidbit. His agent managed $1,000 every time he was stung. Mm-hmm. He ended up making $23,000 extra. They used baby bees. Did you read this?
Yeah, they bred their own special bees so the stings wouldn't be so bad.
Yes.
But then, you know, everybody had to sign a waiver or something, I'm sure, on the set, because so many people go into anaphylactic shock if they get stung by bees.
Yes.
You know, the whole crew had to be prepared for that.
So, all right. So Helen goes back to Cabrini Green.
That's right.
To find Anthony.
Yeah. And they've built this funeral pyre in Cabrini Green around this time.
There's the little boy says it's for the party. But you know what I love the most about about that kindling, that pile of kindling? That was a pretty common sight in New York at the time. And that resonated with me as a kid. Like, there was just these, like, lots that were full of, like, heaps of trash, abandoned cars. So it also added that level of authenticity. This was the type of thing you would see around. But it's right in front of what used to be called Sears Tower.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful wide shot of this, like, garbage heap in front of the beautiful Chicago skyline.
I mean, growing up in D.C., it was the exact same thing. You know, you drive by Capitol Hill and you've got all of the seats of power, but then two blocks over, just rows and rows of abandoned buildings. Mm-hmm. And so this was just urban blight in the late 80s, early 90s.
So Helen figures out, right? The baby Anthony's in the pyre.
Obviously. Safest place for him. Good job, Candyman.
And she knows now there has to be some sort of... She has to fix things at least a little bit, right?
Yeah.
So she goes inside. Great fire stunts. They legit... Like, the both of them had to have gotten at least some semblance of burned or singed. Because they are literally probably one of the most dangerous fire... They're in the trash heap,
right.
And they light... Bernard Rose did not play. They light it on fire. She gets baby Anthony, pushes baby Anthony out. She is just disfigured, burned. But someone in the neighborhood puts her out. And there's a very touching thing that happens where it's like she redeems herself and they get it. The people in the neighborhood understand.
That she didn't do all the stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. And then maybe Candyman was the one that was pulling all the strings.
The little boy sees Candyman, the outline of Candyman in the fire.
Yeah.
So his legend does live on. Mission accomplished, Candyman, right?
Because
they see him, they get it.
So he's like, yes, I'm back.
I'm back in business. And then it goes to Helen's funeral.
Oh, yes. And everybody shows up. So what? This is another thing where, like,
I That's why I failed to see it as a negative thing. Because the beauty of everyone from Cabrini Green marching up to her whack-ass husband who left her. Fuck that dude.
I wrote here in my notes, I feel bad for Trevor. I feel bad for Trevor. Well, he's okay.
Yes. But so they come to her funeral. What's funny is it terrible that they cut to Helen in the casket and she's wearing a flower crown? And I was like, damn, that's so basic.
Okay, you know? Okay. I like that look, though.
Oh, no, it was a very kind gesture. But now in 2019 eyes, I'm like, she wore a Catella flower crown for an eternity. So they come to her funeral and they pay their respects. And watching it now, I think it's like the ultimate tip the hat that these people from Cabrini Green had a much greater understanding of loss and grief than any of these other characters in the film.
That's, you know, right.
They understood that she tried, but she still died. She dies. Yeah. Candyman told her, you're going to die. You're going to bring my legend back. And then we have the ending.
I know, where Trevor feels bad. Yo, he's remorseful. He's sad. He doesn't like his new young wife.
But he,
like,
was cuckolding her the whole time, y'all.
Allegedly. We don't know, man. I mean, you know.
Ninguna allegedly. He was cheating on her. That's the thing that when you watch it multiple times, then you start to pick up on that, where she's like so engulfed in the Candyman lore, she is ignoring these huge red flags. She's like, where were you last night? And he's like, out, you know.
Yeah. He's at the library, man.
Yes.
He's working hard.
And
you got to publish or perish if you're in academia.
So in his anguish, such a great scene. He's like, Helen, Helen, five times into a mirror.
Yeah. Don't look back because Helen shows up.
Helen shows
wearing
up.
Wearing the flower crown, looking good and scary and good.
And you know, got a hook burned hand. And she has a hook hand. They've literally passed the torch. She is now part of the Candyman lore.
She's Candy Woman.
She's Candy Woman. Candy Chick.
Dr. Candy.
Candy Girl. Candy Girl.
Candy Lady, PhD. So, but what's up with that, man? So, would she... This makes me feel like when you become the candy person, you become evil. Like, because Helen was not a bad person. You know, like...
It's the sense of being wronged. She was wronged. When she was locked up in the psych ward, he never visited her.
That's right.
And started repainting the apartment in a month?
Pink.
Moved the shorty in?
Bro, but check it out. Look, I gotta say, I mean, there was a lot of evidence against her. Like, he came home and Bernice is gutted from groin to gullet, looking green and blue from loss of blood. And his wife, who he already is suspecting of being crazy, is in the other room with a knife. Like, I get why there is no reasonable doubt that she did it if you don't believe in ghosts.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Like, now, are you trying to get me to side with Trevor? Because that's not going to happen. But, you know, I can't respect any professor who's like, macking on their
absolutely
their students.
Yeah, let's find other reasons to not like him.
But it's just a very wonderful, in that respect, I could be way off base. The ending in IMO, so then right here, I'm not speaking in a total, you know, this is my interpretation. I think it has one of the most feminist endings of a horror movie, in the respect that for being disenfranchised and there's a level of, she at least takes some semblance of control back. There is a level of, Helen's not done just yet. And also she avenges her, you know, the fact that he cheated on her.
Yeah. I mean, that's why this is good art, man. This is a classic because there's multiple ways to interpret it and there's multiple ends for everybody. And, you know, but like, I wonder if a problem I have is like, so Helen is now, will she go on to kill more people?
Well, so that's why I don't watch any of the other ones.
Right.
But Candyman didn't kill. Yes, right. They do have a mural of her.
Yeah, so now they've got a white avenging demon.
A very Joan of Arc in that respect. It's like her in the fire, yeah. Right? Candyman... Did Candyman cut off? There's a level of like, what is handed down and what is actually true.
Right. Like, did that little boy who got, like, castrated, was that Candyman who did it, or was it a gang leader who was using his name?
Which is something that they bring up. So that's left kind of for interpretation, and also, like, it's very vague. There's never a point where Candyman's like, yeah, I did it, you know, like, that was me all those times. So it's not like he is portrayed... Once again, he's a victim of circumstance, and he's pissed that this woman robbed him of the only thing he had, which was his legacy. It's almost like he is reluctant. His legacy is all he has left. He had a great life. He lived above the. He lived a flawless life and was killed for nothing.
Yeah.
And now you took away the one thing that he had, which was infamy. And so Helen, essentially, it's all she has left. But she only kills. It's not like people are going to start saying Helen into the mirror. It's only a husband, right? You know? Her ex-husband. So who knows?
And Candyman, you know, he is seen as a terror in his own community. And that's an area, too. Like, maybe this is coming back to the same idea, but that, like, as an avenging angel, wouldn't this be cooler if he was killing, gentrifying white people moving into Cabrini Green, which might be... Jordan Peele.
Jordan, hey, we think we might have some ideas on what you're doing there,
yeah.
Which would be beautiful. I mean, frankly.
Yeah. Which then makes this sort of like an urban poltergeist.
Yes. And random, but for urban, an interesting idea fleshed out about an urban community, there is a fantastic episode of The X-Files called X-Cops, and it's modeled to look like an episode of Cops. And the premise... is essentially, does the demon that these people are talking about exist? It's incredibly funny because they're also mocking, at the time, Cops was on Fox. And Cops was a good example of something that was just utilizing these poor disenfranchised people for the network for their own gain.
That's right.
Yeah.
There was a show recently like that was like where they put a car out on the street and it was like a honeypot or a trap to like try to get people to break into it. And then the minute that they did, they'd be arrested. And that was like the whole show.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. So in this episode of The X-Files, it's about they keep getting conflicting interpretations of what the monster is. And it's because the monster is personal to everyone. So when everyone sees it, and it's about the power of rumor. And how, like, I heard that a monster killed the person next door. Well, I've seen it too, and it looks like this. And there's a... interesting theme about like the power of rumor. We don't know if Candyman actually killed a bunch of people in Cabrini Green, but we do know that people feared him and they knew well enough to respect something that was scary.
And that might actually prove Helen's thesis, because her thesis at the beginning was that the people in Cabrini Green were living under such horrific conditions that they created an urban legend to give their lives some meaning.
To rationalize why things were terrible, why people went missing. You can't, it's hard to live with the bitter pill of people go missing because we're poor and no one cares about us. But if you can be like, but there was this slave, he got a white woman pregnant and, you know, was unfairly killed and now he's angry. That is a rationale that you can kind of, oddly enough, sleep better at night with, which is like, I can avoid that.
Yeah,
I respect that.
I listened to the last podcast on the left, which is a fun true crime podcast, and they talked a lot about they had an episode on black serial killers, which blew me away, because at first I thought, what is this going to be, like, racist? What's going on here with this? And there's this myth that there are no black serial killers, right? Like, I'll hear comedians talk about, like, oh, if you hear, like, somebody ate a whole bunch of people, that's a white guy. But the thing is that there's this concept of the less dead that they bring up. And it's that police just don't spend time looking at crime in certain neighborhoods. And so because of that, you can have killers operating for longer because they just don't... it's not a priority to, like, find the killers of black prostitutes or black children. Or, like, you look at the latest season of Mindhunter.
The Atlanta child killings.
Yeah, and they got Wayne Williams. And then there's even conspiracies that Wayne wasn't really... Or not conspiracies, but what is it? Theories that he wasn't...
He didn't kill all of them.
Right, yeah. Right. So these problems still exist.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm very excited to see what Jordan Peele is going to be doing with that female director. Unfortunately, I don't know her name, but it's fantastic that it's also a female directing because, you know, to improve upon. Bernard Rose, in my opinion, did a fantastic job, but that was 1992,
right?
So to improve upon it, it would have been nice for maybe a woman to kind of pitch in Helen's perspective because she's so much... I think Helen is the true monster of Candyman, which is why at the end she comes up.
She literally becomes
the monster. She started out as the monster. Yeah. She flexes and tries to get access to a story that is not her own. She doesn't ever once enable Bernadette to take the lead, which is a very interesting thing because like, you would figure, right?
Yeah.
And then plays in that sandbox, gets burned by it, literally, and then becomes the monster that she is, which is someone who, like, co-opted. She co-opts the Candyman story at the end.
Right. She culturally appropriates.
She culturally appropriates the Candyman story at the end. So who is the bigger monster? Is it Candyman or is it Helen? My vote's for Helen.
Yeah, yeah. I love this movie. And, like, that is such a valid interpretation that really holds weight in 2019. With the wake of things like cultural appropriation becoming bigger, there's like this, for me, there's this fear of, like she's like white urban liberalism, you know, trying to demystify things, trying to make things academic, sort of like killing the frog by dissecting it and creating more of a problem.
Yeah.
And, this film is such a, it's just a great little exploration of gentrification. I love, the Rose's ability, his aerial shots of the city
scope.
Are great.
Yes.
The scope of it is so wonderful. The way that Chicago looks in this movie is fantastic. The camera work is great. The practical effects, Tony Todd kills it. This movie would not exist without Tony Todd being Candyman.
Oh, he's just perfect.
Can't imagine any other actor. He's so iconic as this character. And, you know, he's a smooth monster. You know?
I would say top five smooth monsters, frankly, if not number one in my book. And also, you know, once again, we didn't really delve into this, but the score slaps. God bless Philip Glass. We're sorry that you're disappointed in the movie. But when you have that aerial shot, which was apparently the first of its kind at the time over Chicago, and this creepy organ music, it is just, you're in it, you're strapping in, you're going, we're going there.
Yeah. And as somebody that like grew up in a city, so many horror movies take place in the suburbs or out in the countryside, and this was just like a fun movie that kind of reflected that I was able to identify with growing up in Washington DC in the early 90s. You know, it wasn't Springfield, it wasn't like with Michael Myers, it wasn't the woods.
No, and actually, in that respect, the one scene that really resonated with me as a child was when they pull up and they're like, "Oh, who are you here to see?"
Yeah,
I keeping it really real. Bushwick was like that. You would go up to any one of the buildings that were it's like that large, like the Marcy houses, and there were people that were kind of like, you know, "What are you here to do? Who do you know? What apartment?" And there was situations where it was, you know, access was denied and or was given, but under the feeling that something bad could happen if you didn't behave or play by the rules that they had already set there.
That's funny. That's, you know? I was looking on Twitter, scrolling through Twitter, and we know the new Joker movie just came out, and there's like these iconic, the promo shots are him dancing
on the stairs staircase in the Bronx,
and they're good. And like people on Twitter are like, "Oh, how do I go there? Like, I want to go there. Let's go check out the stairs." And then other people are commenting like, "Don't go. You're going to get robbed." Like, encouraging them to go there to get robbed. And I know those stairs because they're near 176th Street, off the 456. And I would walk up those stairs every day to go teach. And like, it's not scary at all. Like, but it is, but you do have to know, I mean, you know, people notice you when you're walking through there if you're not from there.
especially if you got white face paint on you, ding dong. And also, like, frankly, I wish I could support that GoFundMe of people to rob people on the Joker stairs. I think that works.
I used to go buy burnt CDs on that staircase because the guys would be selling CDs right there. So,
but that's like the staircase. Chalk it up to another famous set of stairs, the Exorcism stairs. Sure. That's a real place, right? Yeah.
Dude, so the thing about those, they're in Georgetown. It's a very nice part of the city right next to Georgetown University. But you know, you smoke weed halfway up the stairs so that if anybody's coming down, you can just walk down faster than them. If anybody's coming up, you can walk up faster than them.
Ooh, look at Gabe giving us the tips.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, thank you so much for having me. Yeah. This, it was great to talk about a film that I feel emotionally, as someone who was priced out of Bushwick, I think it means a lot to me in a very fun way. I love talking about it. And also just on the base level, like horror movie, it's a wonderful, fantastic, beautiful film. And to all the listeners, if you feel a way about Candyman that goes against some of my ideas, we
reach
should
out.
Talk. Yeah. Let's talk about it. I would love to hear your perspective. And I respect completely that as a person who is not black, you may disagree or think that there are cultural milestones. And for if I was younger and someone was bringing up Candyman as a way to make me feel terrible about my culture, then yeah, I probably wouldn't like it as much. So I'm respectfully just saying that much and love to hear from you. But yeah, Bernard Rose, thank you for creating this wonderful film. And shout out to Tony Todd, who's still working.
That's right. He's hopefully he's in the next one too. I give this movie 5 bee stings.
Good job.
Out of 5.
Well, thank you, Gabe, for having me on.
Thank
Pray
you.
Josh.
Zilla, where can people find you?
Oh, I'm on Instagram, at Zilla Vodnus. That's my preferred. I know. Get me on the gram. And I'm a comedian that works in New York, so you can catch me. If you look at my IG, you will see where my next show is. And I do tell a lot of jokes about horror movies, so I'll be on brand.
Yes, and you can find me at GabePacheco.com for everything. And please rate, review, and subscribe to Eat, Pray, Judge. IG is the best way to interact with us, so we're on Instagram at Eat, Pray, Judge Pod. And come out to Funhouse Comedy every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. at Cantina Royal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Alright,
peace.
Bye. You ain't a writer, nor a fighter. You're just a biter. I think you need to save all that, because in spite of the reputation that you think you have, the crew already knows that you're really a crab. So I'll grab the mic with haste and send you out of this place, back to trace my flow. But don't waste your time, bro. It only takes a minute, a second for me to switch and rearrange real quick, because I can kick plenty styles, rhyme, stretch many miles.